Good evening, everybody. It's great to be able to welcome you all here on behalf of Stickard, which, as I hope you know, is currently celebrating its 25th anniversary. This is the second of three lectures which are being given by chairs or former chairs of Stickard in celebration of that. Some of you I know were at Tony Atkinson's lecture. We have Howard this evening, and I haven't written down the date of the next one. Anyway, I'll announce at the end of this. I'll announce the date of the following lecture, which I do have in my pocket. It's a huge pleasure for me to welcome Howard Glenister to give this lecture. Howard has been an inspiration and a support to me throughout my whole time with the Welfare State Programme, first of all, and then as part of the Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion within Stickard. Over on top of the library building. Howard is Emeritus Professor of Social Policy here, as I'm sure almost everybody knows. He's also a former chairman of Stickard itself. Howard's been thinking about these issues, I'm afraid to say, for at least 45 years. I don't know whether he's actually been thinking about them for even longer than that, but his publications on related subjects range from a Fabian pamphlet on national assistance back in 1962, through a huge number of publications on topics, all of which, in one way or another, are relevant to tonight's lecture, from topics covering education, the health service, tax credits, the delivery of personal social services, the history of social policy, and, as appositely as any, his most recent book, published last year, Understanding the Finance of Welfare, which, if you haven't read it, I would recommend very highly indeed as a succinct and up-to-date coverage of the topic. Who else could be better placed than Howard to lecture on this topic? Can we afford our future? Howard.
Well, thank you very much, John, for kind words. And welcome to all of you who I see, some from Stickard and many I don't know. Well, this is the 25th anniversary of Stickard, and 25 years ago, Micho Morishima shared a dream with us, or at least with Lord Darendorf, who was then director of the school. Micho believed that economists and other social scientists lacked the laboratory atmosphere that natural scientists enjoyed, the informal environment, as he saw it, in which academics and young staff and PhD students from all over the world could work together and do so in a friendly and supportive environment. Well, as a theorist, he also believed that you couldn't separate theory, that generating better theories was a part of applied work and not some sort of higher order thing which went on in some different place. And the best ideas are simple ones, I suppose, and Micho's was no exception. Today, I hope that Stickard, and I know it does, embodies a large part of that dream. We'd like more money, we'd like more people from overseas, but it is a living outcome of that dream that he had 25 years ago. And we owe him an enormous debt, and we wish him well. Well, this evening I want to try to cover a big topic, one of the big issues of our time. How should we respond to the economic challenges implied by a longer life, falling fertility, growing inequality, and our rising expectations of what we want from our public services? Now, that's a powerful cocktail in combination. And these issues are too often, I think, considered separately. Now, in doing this, I'm going to be drawing on colleagues' work, past and present. I don't hold them at all to my conclusions, but essentially I shall be using some of the work that was done in Stickard right from its beginning on policy simulation models, begun by Tony Atkinson and Holly Sutherland, and then Jane Falkingham and Maria Rivandrew, and Anne Harding, and of course John. they've given us a way of thinking about the future and testing options in a way that wasn't possible before STICKED was formed. Now, of course, as an aged person, I'm not suggesting that there's anything wrong with living a long time. As I used to tell my students, I've long outlived my expectation of life as it was in 1936, by a good many years. And I hope the students that I taught, the grandchildren who I see every week, and take home from school and help with their homework, and the people indeed in STICKED, don't view my continued existence as a kind of total burden. But that doesn't alter the fact that demographic changes carry large economic and fiscal implications. And I think, and this will be a theme of the lecture, that many people are failing to properly appreciate. Well, let's start with some fundamentals. In December 2003, the government actuary changed its population estimates. It assumed that life was going to go on growing, as it were, longer than they'd assumed previously. At a stroke, they raised the expected numbers of over 75s by 10%, or 700,000 people, by 2031. That's no bad achievement as a stroke of a demographer's pen. And thanks to John for this particular slide. The consequence is, as you can see, this shows you the proportion of the population in each age range along the bottom, and this by 2051, the number of people living over the age of 60 and 65 and so on is pushed that way, more of them, and less people in that early age band. Now, despite the attention that's devoted to these longer lives, what people talk of as an aging society, in economic terms, it's our failure to produce as many babies and hence future workers that is a real problem, perhaps the most fundamental problem, which in a sense underlies this first part of that graph. I have to say that going into STICKED, this does not seem to be the major problem. Every time I seem to go into STICKED, there's some proud new mum or dad showing off some new offspring. So perhaps, you know, STICKED's ahead of the curve, as it is in some other ways too, I hope. But that's not true of the population at large. In the mid-1930s, that was it, were my generation of women born in the mid-1930s, they had on average 2.5 children in a statistical sense. And that's before we get to these curves. By 1947, the figure had fallen to 2.2. By 1957, the figure was only 2. And it's now assumed that this curve will go on. I mean, nobody really knows what to do with these curves at the bottom there, or sort of got a guesswork moving them upwards. But nevertheless, the idea is that by the women born in 1972, the figure will have fallen to 1.74. The big difference compared with previous generations is that a lot of women, 20%, are not having any children at all. Fertility rates in some other European countries are lower, quite significantly lower than that, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4 in Spain, Italy, Germany, and so on. People try and explain this. I've read the demography articles very carefully, and they list the reasons. Women's greater economic independence, their longer education, their greater economic autonomy, and so on. But above all, perhaps, the stress of home and work responsibilities taken in combination. But seems to me it's still largely guesswork. However, the implications are striking. Assuming no immigration, a fertility rate of 1.5 means that the population will halve in 44 years. Or another way of thinking about it is in terms of pensioner support ratios, so that we've got that in the early part of mid-century, as it were, of the last century. There are 4.5 potential workers supporting each pensioner. Now the figure is 3.5, and by 2050 it will be 2.5. And of course it's not just demography. The age at which men have been withdrawing from the labour force has been falling at the same time as life expectancy has been rising. In the United Kingdom, nearly half of all men, have left the labour force by the age of 60. The average age of leaving is 62 and a bit. Remember that in 1880, 3/4 of men over the age of 65 were still working. And the same figure was true for the United States. Indeed, in 1910, the average age at which men actually left the labour force, as opposed to dying off in it, was 74. So this decline in the working age has been very significant. And then, of course, on top of that, one has the distribution of spending by age. You can see from that graph that the expenditure on an over 85-year-old is 5 times that in all those public services taken together compared to the 35 to 55-year-old. But it's quite a mistake to think that this is just about taxation or public expenditure, because exactly the same funding issues arise with private pensions or private insurance of any other kind. Many firms have not adjusted their employees or their own contributions to pension schemes adequately, and many took sort of misjudged pension holidays in the 1980s. Perhaps even more perverse is the current switch that's taking place from defined benefits to defined contributions, which may have their arguments in them on their own merits. But in the process of that happening, firms are reducing their contributions to their pension schemes at the same time as life expectancy is rising. And then there is the rising expectations that people have of public services that I've already talked about, where the government has been driven to promise unprecedented increases in health and education, which is coming on top of the ageing issue. And then on top of that, which we often forget, are the fiscal implications of the growing inequality that Tony Atkinson was talking about in the first lecture in this series. There's more redistributive work to be done, if you like. There's a greater degree of reduction in the Gini coefficient, to put it in technical terms, that is necessary now than was true during the time of the Attlee government. So we're redistributing in a way that wasn't necessary in some sense in the 1940s and 50s, just because of the dramatic changes in income distribution that we've seen. It's costing more to secure the safety net than it was a generation ago. So the question is, can we really have it all? High quality public services, more rich to poor redistribution, and more redistribution, as it were, from the young to the old. Any one of these would be a problem on their own. Now, let's switch line of argument for a moment. There's a perfectly plausible argument that we shouldn't get too fussed about all of this. In the past century, we've adjusted to very big changes in the demographic structure, bigger than anything envisaged in the coming century. The likely growth rates in productivity that will outpace the effects of the decline in the number of people in the population. So we may still enjoy an improved standard of living, as the House of Lords Economic Select Committee pointed out in a recent very good report at the end of last year. In the past century, we've also adjusted partly through many more women entering the labour force. Of course, there's a limit to the extent that can go on, because so much has happened in the past century. But if the United Kingdom increased the participation of women in the labour market to Swedish or Danish levels, it would, in a sense, solve the problem. True, but that is a big change in ways of organising our families and our working lives. It would mean a change from what Jane Lewis has called a 1.5 earner family to a nearly 2 full-time earner family model. And Britain has been significant in adopting this 1.5 earner model as opposed to the Swedish model. So, change possible, but it is a significant social change. In the 20th century, we increased the share of the GDP going to social welfare expenditure, and we did so to a significant extent because of the changing aid structure. But that increased the proportion of the GDP going to social welfare spending from 1948 to 76 from 15% to 25% from 48 to 76. Well, we've done it before, argument can run, perhaps we can do it again. Well, that's definitely not the Treasury government case. That case is that there isn't a fiscal problem. And my case is that there is. How so? Well, no problem. That's one view, what I'm going to call the official view. First is that changes in demography will only have a small impact on the economy and services like health and long-term care. It's all fiscally sustainable without any significant tax increases. Read various Treasury publications over the last couple of years. The United Kingdom has already taken the steps that are necessary, especially in the pension field. We've got a well-developed funded pension scheme arrangements, and they will provide more as most people come to become part of them. People will save more on a lifetime savings model as they expect to grow older. They will save more. And the extra saving will produce growth in productivity and output that will compensate for the decline in the number of workers. Thirdly, it's not as if the levels of pension that are generated by a short-term working life may begin to make people work longer. As people recognise that their pensions are not, as it were, going to be big enough, they will begin to work longer. Now, one can already see this beginning to happen, you could argue, in the United States, and I'll come back to that. Women are working for a longer part of their lives. It'll all work out. In short, if you like, the Brits have got it all sorted, one way or another, in our usual adept way, and even if others haven't, we're all right. Well, can we really believe this? Well, let's look at the Treasury projections of expenditure. The reassuring message here on health and long-term care is drawn from some reasonably good information. The Wanless report did look at the medical and epidemiological research. A better educated populace could very well produce healthier lifestyles. There's some American and some Scottish evidence that shows that moderate levels of ability are declining in older people. Much of the costs of the healthcare system are related to the age at which we die. Dying's a costly business, but fortunately, so I'm told, we only die once, at least in this life. So one may accept that there's some good evidence underlying some of that. The long-term care figures, I'll come back to, seem to me to be a little optimistic. Essentially what is being done here is to assume that the whole cost of more people entering long-term care is to be made up by, or is to be counterbalanced by, this reduction in disability and the need for services as people get older, which is very convenient. What it doesn't do is to assume a significant improvement in standards, in relative standards of old people's care compared with the rest of the services. And my guess is that people are going to become more demanding. They may live longer, but they're also going to be more demanding about the nature of the social care provision they receive. However, I think one might say that the service projections are perhaps somewhat optimistic, but not incredible, not nonsense. It's when we come to the spending on pensions and benefits for the over 65s that the soothing message, I think, becomes frankly incredible. The politics and the economics and the equity implications of these projections seem to me to be highly questionable. Let's just take the politics first. On present policies, the Treasury suggests that the total amount spent on state pensions and other over 65 benefits are going to fall slightly as a proportion of the GDP, despite the growth in older numbers of older people. And this is made possible, of course, by the fact that pensions and other benefits are going to be linked to prices and not earnings. The spending per pensioner as a proportion of average earnings is going to fall from about 18% today to 13% in 2050. All this, remember, at a time when pensioners are becoming a larger and larger share of the electorate. So that seems to me something a bit queerisome about, as it were, the political economy that lies behind some of those projections. But what about the economics? All pensions are a claim by non-producers on the tradable goods and services produced by current workers. Claims on these goods and services can be taken away from current workers by force of law, by tax, and paid to pensioners. Or current and future generations of workers have got to be persuaded to consume less by saving more to free resources for the growing elderly population. Various ways you can think about it, but that seems to me the simplest. So savings incentives matter an awful lot. However, and this should be familiar ground to some of you, if state pensions don't rise with earnings and means-tested benefit levels, pension credit and so on, does rise with earnings, the numbers facing some kind of significant means test on their future pension is going to grow. From to perhaps 65, 70, 80%, you choose your model, you get a different answer. Many people should, however, even if that were true, find it beneficial to save. But the sheer complexity of that kind of future, uncertainty about what it is that is going to be the outcome of this particular kind of means-tested maze, could, I think, entirely plausibly make a major disincentive to saving. The point is, if it may very well be true that at present individuals are going to go on saving if they don't understand the system. The more they begin to understand the system, the less they may want to save. And the whole issue of the future complexity of the system does seem to me to be a major problem when one's dealing with people taking rational decisions about investing in private pension schemes. A smaller, younger population is still going to have to pay taxes, remember, to support the older generation, who have not been able to take out these private pensions or haven't done so in the past. Even if young people do save more for their pensions, they may not save more overall. More pension saving may reduce other saving. And even if they do save the extra, that may not translate into extra pensions, given the volatility of asset markets that people may worry about. My point here is simply that there's a lot of uncertainty that lies behind these steps in the logic. Most people who are now going to be joining defined contribution schemes will face these kind of private or system risks on top of the private risks they may face from being women or out of the labour market or in the caring activity. Some kind of secure foundation for all this assumed and hoped for private pension spending is critical. What about the kind of argument that it'll all sort itself out without any policy change? People will simply rebalance their life plans and work longer and adjust to a lower expectation of life in retirement. There's clearly something in that. I know we get rather besotted with incomes in these debates. And what we really should be worrying about is utility. Anne and I are living on a income, which is 55% of our previous earnings. Our children are gone, our mortgages are gone, and above all, I don't have any dreadful academic committees to sit on. I don't have the RAE to worry about. I don't have to mark any exams. And I tell you, living on 55% of one's income is not a bad deal in the absence of all of that, which many of you here are labouring under. My problem here is that we're not all ex-professors. And we know from the US research that people are remarkably ill-informed about their future pension prospects. Indeed, we know that here too. Indeed, there's the interesting study in the December issue of the American Economic Review, which showed that the poor and the young in Britain didn't change their saving habits, as it were, logically, in the faced with the huge drop in pension prospects that resulted from some of the policy changes in the 1980s. It was the higher income groups and the older groups that did. And all of that is, as it were, without considering the gender implications. Though the state's second pension has some limited means of recompensing for periods in care or caring, private pension schemes don't. In short, there are distributional consequences that underpin some of the assumptions. Now, what happens if we begin to assume that the politics of pensions goes wrong? And here I'm just making some guesses about future spending in relation to the age range. Now, if we assume that health spending is right, people will get tired of throwing more money at doctors as a way of improving their health and realise that there may be better ways of using the money, well, I'm prepared, for the sake of argument, as it were, to take the health projections. Education too, essentially what the government here is doing is to take advantage of the reduction in the number of the people in the school population. The expenditure goes up and about till about 2011 and then goes down a little as a proportion of the GDP. But remember that factored into that is nothing to do with the graduate contribution, which is going to come in and add what in effect is a kind of graduate tax, which people may, it's not in those sums because it's not in the public accounts, but it's going to be a tax. So it perhaps in some sense ought to be there if you're thinking about, you know, fiscal sustainability. Long-term care costs I've pushed up a bit, both because of the larger population, but mainly because of my suspicion about the assumptions on the, as it were, the unit costs. However, the major problem is with, as I've already indicated, the benefits, both the economic and the political logic, which lies behind the proposition that you can sustain, you can keep benefits simply rising in terms of in line with prices. If we were to drop that assumption just for the over 65s, it would add another 3.6% of the GDP to the benefit costs. And if those benefits were going up in relation to earnings or average GDP per capita or whatever, other sorts of benefits would probably follow behind. And that would take away the savings that the Treasury are assuming will come from lower expenditure on benefits for the rest of the population. Now, you could argue, well, that's all right, because we can raise the level of taxation. Well, indeed, but this is really a big increase in the total level of tax. It's an increase of about a fifth in the total level of taxation. And I don't see any political party going around tub-thumping saying, what we've got to do over the next decade or two is raise taxes by a fifth. No political parties, so far as I can see, committed to raising any more in tax, and two of them are committed to reducing tax. So what are we arguing from this? Well, our future. There are, as it were, four options. There is paying more in tax, there is reducing midlife consumption patterns, there is working longer, and there is getting used to lower incomes in retirement. Again, I don't see this sort of, you know, on the front burner in terms of political debate or option setting. I've already talked a little bit about the tax side of things, and so I'll move on to reducing midlife consumption a bit. In writing my recent book that John mentioned, I wrote round to, phoned up with my wife's help, various insurance companies and asked them about a model family earning with a joint income of £40,000 a year. What would it take to get a decent pension, take out long-term care insurance, have decent health care insurance, and so on? And it worked out that this was going to cost that family about a third of their income, which is a good deal more than the equivalent taxes they were paying to finance equivalent services currently. All sorts of reasons behind that, but and they may indeed get better services. But anything that is a significant impact on midlife, as it were, consumption expectations. We could say, well, let's not do anything about that. Just let's keep all paying all of that the same. Let's not pay any more tax. Just let's work longer. Well, that would mean working until the age of 73. Much less than that has brought riots on the continent, and for some reason. Simply to raise the age at which pensioners can draw a full pension means that there will be losers, unless you do something about it, in the less skilled, poorer sections of the community. As Tanya Burkhart's work shows, many of those who are not employed before retirement have low skills, poor health, and are not attractive to employers. To raise the pension age to 70 would reduce my expected years of pension by about a quarter, but they reduce the manual workers by about 40%. In other words, to get anything like this kind of policy through, and I'm going to come out and say I think we should work longer at the end, you've got to have some gainers. There've got to be winners in this, as well as the expectation that you're going to be a loser. So what might we try and do? How can we sell the future? That sort of future. Well, in the long term, I think we have to begin to do something about fertility, tackling the compatibility of family life and children and work, introducing good child care and education from the age of 3 or earlier, whatever the current discussions are about. There are very good reasons for doing this in terms of, as it were, education and social mobility and social exclusion, but it might also turn out to be a good pensions policy. Being more relaxed about immigration might help in the short run to maintain the present age balance, but that would mean an awful lot more people coming into the country. I mean, one estimate was that you'd need to accept 500,000 new workers a year from abroad. And one can see the Daily Mail's response to that. They're presumably completely bonkers. But the problem is, of course, that in the long run, immigrants age too. I'm persuaded by lots of work I've done in the past that market failures in health and long-term care suggest that some kind of tax-funded service is going to be the most economically sensible for most people a long way into the future, just because of the nature of the market failures involved in those services. But if I'm right, and there are going to be significant implications for the provision of social care, local authority council tax reform makes even more sense than it does on other grounds. I think there are better ways of capturing the property values to offset long-term care, and I think the government could be of some help there, but that's a rather complicated issue. Come back to it if you like, but there are ways in which one could increase the flow of income given my presumptions, into long-term care, or making private insurance of long-term care more attractive than it ever looks as if it's going to be currently. But essentially, what one has to do is to create a stable pensions policy. There's some degree of consensus, I think, beginning to emerge on some of this, though not, as it were, within government. I don't know, perhaps I'm wrong about that. It seems to me that a feasible future here must contain the following kinds of principles. Private saving has got to be based on a secure state platform. There's got to be a baseline above means tests. There has to be a higher full pension age. There has to be some security against private system and personal risks. And you have to begin to redress some of the gender issues that are involved in the model we're moving to. All of those things, it seems to me, require significant changes in the way we think about pensions policy. For example, raising the full pension age would have to be a significant part of paying for some of the other benefits that precede them. But the argument here is that a strategy like this would give some winners, as well as greater security. Now, doesn't this look a bit like back to Beveridge? Well, yes, in one sense, it does. Beveridge was, major part of the Beveridge argument was that there did have to be a secure platform. But the issues about gender and redistribution were not, at least in the Beveridge report, a kind of major plank. Our appreciation of these issues has moved on a lot since Beveridge. What has actually happened in recent decades, I would argue, is that we've moved on from unemployment insurance, which has been subsumed into quite a distinctly different pattern of providing for unemployment through the Job Seekers Allowance and the New Deal and so on. And similarly, sickness insurance has moved to a pattern of employer provision and recompense through the social security system. And meanwhile, the old Beveridge pension is virtually going to disappear under this model, to be replaced by a second pension, which is targeted on the poor. So in many ways, I think we ought to, as it were, hang up a sign, shop closed, over the whole Beveridge era. Terrible things to say in the LSE, but I've come to the conclusion that we are increasingly living in a kind of Kafkaesque Gothic cathedral, if that is a too hopeless mixture of metaphors, which absolutely nobody out there really understands. And if what you're trying to do is to get people to think about rationally their own futures in a private pension market, you know, Kafkaesque Gothic cathedrals are not the best place to do it, especially if they're clouded with a good deal of incense. So I've been driven, I think, something against my expectations, to think increasingly about a more fundamental change to the pension system. I think in some ways we've got the pre-pension system with all sorts of odd excrescences built onto it moving in the right direction. What still seems to me to be, as I say, hopelessly bizarre is the current pension arrangement. And that, if we look around the world for some sort of model, are there any? Well, quite interestingly, I think, is the Dutch pension arrangements. Much debated. I mean, the Dutch have got a very generous pension scheme, which is being criticized for being far too generous and so on and so on. But it does have some characteristics that are worth holding on to. One is that it has an even bigger funded pension sector than we do, with something like equivalent to 120% of its GDP, as it were, tied up in pension assets. Most of the schemes are on a compulsory industry-wide basis, or semi-compulsory, and the big firms like Shell and Philips have their own schemes. There are changes taking place to all of that, certainly. But the interesting thing is that in 1956, they abandoned a means-tested pension arrangement on the grounds that this they thought was having an effect on incentives. And they began designing the present system in the 1950s, certainly when assumptions about generosity were much more different than ours today. So, I mean, I think you could say, well, we don't want to look at the Dutch system, you know, they've got it all wrong, it's much too generous, it's too expensive, though not as expensive as quite a number of others. However, as I say, I think there are some important principles to hang on to. Critically, the pension is... Lost it.
Maybe try the control of the micro on
this one.
Yeah, try the up and down arrows on the.
Got that. Good. It's drawn at the age of 65. Women earlier if it's not working. Contributions take the form of a percentage tax on people's income. Entitlement gradually develops over 40 years of residence. Pension takes virtually, the basic pension takes virtually everybody off means testing. And it's adjusted as wages rise, though that can be linked to demography in the legislation. Now, the idea is that that plus the occupational addition will give people a 70% replacement rate. Now, I'm not suggesting anything like that. What I am suggesting is that a firmer base has meant there have been strong incentives for people to agree to become members of a funded scheme. Hence the near 100% coverage achieved by the tripartite employer, government and union bargaining. As I've said, such is the ignorance of pension issues in this country and some of the, that I think any kind of compulsory membership of pension schemes without some platform would be politically impossible. As I said earlier, I don't buy the argument entirely that funded pension schemes are the best or even the only, certainly not the only, model for pension reform. I do argue that having gone down that route, there's no way back, and that a flat rate citizen's pension might have a lot to commend it. It would enable us to abolish the basic state pension, the second state pension, and the pension credit. And most of the reliance on means testing would disappear. But it would have to be a scaled down Dutch model. The Dutch have no employer or employee contributions. As I said, it's done through the tax system. The revenue comes through the income tax system, and that would be an enormous change. I mean, we all know as economists that the employer's contribution is, in a sense, paid by the worker in reduced wages. But voters might find that very difficult to understand. So you might have to move to some kind of system that envisaged a social security tax paid by employer and employee together. But my proposition is that if we were to introduce such a system with these advantages, it would give incentives to join funded schemes. It would be simple. There would be no complex contribution records, nor the problems that, as it were, the gender problems that arise in people being dependent upon husbands' pensions and such. It does not have the advantage, it does have advantages for women, and it does have a degree of progressive funding. Now, the extent to which that kind of system could be introduced would depend upon the extent to which you were prepared to counter that, to compensate for those, that generosity, as it were, by increasing the pension age. When you would do it, I think, is a matter for, by pension age, I mean the age at which people take a full pension. My reckoning is that you would be able to do that on a relatively costless basis if you raise the pension age to something like 68. But you would have to compensate a group of people who would lose out if you simply were to move from one scheme to another, which I know is never politically possible anyway. And those, of course, are the people who have their benefits that have accrued in SERPs and in the second state pension scheme. They would have, as it were, to be grandfathered in. And the scheme would need to be pushed sometime into the future in order to be able to, as it were, minimise the effects of those costs. But in a sense, the people's minds you're trying to change here are those people who are currently thinking about their future pension. And if they could see that the future that lay before them was one that was, as it were, a simpler one rather than a complex Byzantine one, that might have significant advantages. So the advantages of that scheme do seem to me to be significant and worth facing some of the political unpopularity that would flow from a rather earlier pension age. If you made the plans for this sufficiently far in advance, people would begin to get used to that idea. And as I say, above all, you would have something to sell in terms of simplicity. The other consequence you would have to follow up would be the other set of losers. Another set of losers would be those people who, as I said at the outset, would be those who were not able to retire late. Those people who are on, who are sicker, have been in manual work, have long-term disabilities, are needing to leave the labour force earlier. And that is why I've suggested an age of, you'd have to compensate for that by putting at the age at which you were seeking to raise the full-time pension to a later time than you would if you were simply relying on, as it were, a neutral cost of the programme without taking into account the compensation for those losers. So essentially what I've been trying to argue is that it's not true to say, we have to look together at the combination of factors. It's not just about ageing. It's about the fact that we've got distribution of income effects. We've got an older population. We've got the issue of rising expectations, which I'm trying to build in, for example, in thinking about a long-term care debate, as well as the equity issues that arise from some of the propositions that are being made about what one should do to pension policy. And if you take together the long-term ageing issues together with these other expectation of life and the expectation of standards, I think you begin to get to a much more difficult set of issues than simply, as it were, thinking about ageing on its own. And to conclude, thinking about those things together makes me conclude in a way that I think I was not expecting to a year or two ago, that we do need to move to a much more fundamental kind of pension reform than has been on the agenda, at least in sort of mainstream political party debate for some time. And I think there's some degree of consensus beginning to grow about some of that. Moving from here to there is not going to be easy, and I've tried to suggest some of the losers and some of that would have to be who would have to be compensated in the process. But we've got to get out of a Kafkaesque Gothic cathedral and try to move to some rather more Romanesque pattern of architecture, I think.
Thank you very much indeed, Howard. You've given us food for thought, not just for this evening, but I suspect for most of the next 50 years. We have a few minutes. Howard has kindly agreed to take questions. Could you do three things in terms of questions? Could you wait until somebody arrives with a microphone? Could you say who you are? And could you keep your questions and comments brief, please, so that Howard has a chance to respond and so that other people have a chance to put their points? And I think we'll take questions for about 10 minutes or so. Yeah, thank you. So at the back, Bernard, Casey, and then just in front, and then over here, please.
Bernard Casey, short. I used to be much more sanguine about long-term care. I've actually began to realise that it's physical dependency might be the problem as much as financial dependency, and that if we are having higher demands upon care, this is either going to push an awful lot back onto late middle-aged women in particular, and this is going to keep them out of the labour market, which is going to have the negative effects that were expected by increasing female participation. I'm very concerned about what that is going to mean, the gender dimension of long-term care, and I am not sanguine as you are. Especially, I would say, looking at those long-term projections, which I did at OECD, I think they're extraordinarily dodgy and much dodgier than any long-term projections which we have about pensions.
Let's take three points and then give Howard a chance to respond. So just in front first, please. Yeah. Yeah.
My name is Ken West, which may bring some memories back to Howard. You mentioned in a kind of a jocular fashion about utility and how you were finding it somewhat better not to have to do a lot of work that you probably wouldn't have wanted to do when you were in full-time work. But would it be possible, or is it impractical, for there to be a kind of a gradual retirement, rather than you're 65, you're 70, whatever, and you pack up work? Why not try to have a more flexible retirement program where you, in my case, I was kind of fortunate that it was sort of forced on me, but you know, if you could perhaps have some work and some pension, rather than all work and no pension, and then just pension and no work at all.
And then third point. Would you mind waiting for the microphone?
Hello. I'm Nicholas Hyman. I seem to hear that you want the earnings link restored. I think this could be done on an EU-wide basis, and I think you would notice that in terms of voting behaviour, you do have a possible block of grey power to make this happen. Thank you.
How would you like to?
Well, I entirely take the point about the long-term care projections. It's all very well doing the numbers. It's as it were the differential burden that some of this implies. I mean, I'm not sure that. I mean, there is a. It depends essentially how far you believe the compression of morbidity figures. And I've suggested that at the moment these models do assume a rather significant compression. I mean, in this compared with the cost. I mean, the assumption is that it's going to entirely take care. If you look at the Treasury figures on long-term care from 2010 onwards, they're absolutely identical. 1.2 of GDP, 1.2, 1.2. You know, the graph I begin with is still there, but they're going on. Therefore, the whole saving, as I said, is due to. Now, if that's true, then there won't be any more need for support, for whichever gender is doing the caring. And of course, you've also got the fact that people will be older. Depends on what stage. I mean, if what you're assuming is that people will retire later, that in a sense is. Compresses the care capacity. And this is a good example of where, as it were, pensions forecasts and long-term care forecasts do begin to, as it were, overlap in a rather destructive way. So it turns out that the critical assumption that you're making there is about the compression of morbidity. And there are
members of CASE who would worry about that and are much less convinced by the evidence than some of the people who take the other view. So, I mean, I think you put your finger on what's a critical assumption that's being made there, and the evidence is really, there, but not very strong in England, and some counter-evidence as well, I think. So, yeah, right. The gradual, I see you, Ken, the gradual move into retirement is something I'm going to talk more about and didn't. Yes, I mean, I think this is, an important part of adjustment. I mean, one's lucky as an academic, one can do this. One can go on writing, on keeping on with some of one's own habits without, as it were, stopping completely overnight. Now, it's interesting if you look at the American data on this. Over half the people who retire in America go on to do part-time work. I mean, in the formal labour force. I mean, it's something like 60% or something like that, looking at the figures there for 2 or 3 years ago. And it's really a very interesting phenomenon. And that partly has to do with the nature of the American economy and the ease with which people start up very small enterprises of one sort. And a lot of these people are self-employed. They move from being employed to self-employed, not just being consultants, but I mean, just an enormous range of occupations. So I think if the labour market's flexible enough, to go back to that issue, and it's possible for people to shift, and firms themselves take this on as a much more important part of their strategy, personnel strategy. And if the pension arrangements, above all, the regulations that govern pensions, private occupational pensions, make this possible, there are a lot. I was on a committee that looked at this quite some time ago, and there are all sorts of regulatory rules within the pension arrangements that people can take up, including some tax rules, which make it very attractive for employers to chop people off at the knees, as it were, at a given age. And something's being done to address some of those issues, but they are very important. The graying power. Well, yes. One of the interesting things is that graying power is not as mobilised as it could be, or one might expect it to be. Though that may be changing, and this was my point about the political economy of the projections not being entirely, secure in that sense. Or it's a bit odd that one should be assuming this degree of withdrawal. There may be good reasons for it. I mean, in terms of fiscal probity, whether or not governments are going to be able to get away with that particular route is quite another matter.
Okay. There's a point in the middle, and one in the middle there, and another to my right on the balcony, please.
Peter Sozu, there are a number of interesting issues here. I'd like to raise just one, related to the dependency ratio. There's a paradox, which is that as a society we're becoming generally more prosperous, we're becoming more efficient in production, distribution, and so on, the proportion of people's income that they can spend on discretionary leisure spending rather than their everyday needs is going up. So that would suggest that as a society as a whole, we should be able to sustain a high dependency ratio. Clearly, the problem is partly one is distribution, how to actually distribute the funds. And clearly, a problem with increasing taxation, of course, is that it creates all sorts of inefficiencies. It creates disincentives and distortions and so on. Now, there was another talk I almost went to tonight about environmental taxation. I'm glad I went to this one instead. Because it's a very good talk, but I think the two issues are somewhat related in the sense that if we could shift towards raising revenue from other sources that didn't produce economic distortions and were neutral or even positive, then it could be that we could sustain higher spending on things like pensions. So, for example, we had the mobile phone auctions that raised several billion pounds. We had a talk about it here, of course, that Stick had supported a couple of years ago. And that was an example of something that was designed to be economically efficient, giving the licenses to the people that want to pay the most for them, but in the process actually raise money. You could imagine many other processes that would actually be economically enhancing from an efficiency point of view, but also raise revenue, like increased charges for road use, increased energy taxes, and so on. Do you see that as making a contribution towards resolving this funding problem?
Could we take another point also on the balcony, and then down on my right in the front here, please?
I'm Caroline Needham from the International Longevity Centre UK. What role do you feel the increased levels of owner occupation, particularly for the baby boomer generation, can play in actually helping people sustain a better standard of living in later life?
And then I think finally from this, and we'll give Hal a chance to wrap up.
Hello, two-part question. My name's Andy Bookers. How are other economies coping with this problem, especially USA, Japan, possibly also China, India? And the second part of the question, you mentioned immigration very briefly. With the Eastern European extension, can we assume that when there will be more free positions and jobs in the UK, that people will start migrating over here, especially from nations with a higher fertility rate?
Yeah. Well, on environmental taxes, but there's a general case for a more, as it were, efficient taxation system. I mean, that's quite a separate avenue of argument. Though, you know, given that there are, I think, various forms of more improving the efficiency of taxes by taxing bads, if you like. That makes the makes taxation somewhat less inefficient than it might have been. What I was trying to do was not say we've got to raise more taxes. I was saying that there are some quite significant choices to be made. And you may very well argue that we've got to think much more seriously about developing the private pension market and more successfully. My proposition was that if you do that, you've got to produce a more effective, simpler, more understandable and less perverse incentive structured state pension system. These two things are critically linked. Owner occupation. Yes, I mean, I think the government does have a role to play here. There is quite a lot of, as it were, capital. People are capital rich and income poor in their old age, and also care poor. There is scope for trying to put more of that together. It's not a huge solution because, you know, if you do the sums, it doesn't solve all the finance. But I've toyed with the idea, I must say, of a kind of graduate tax in reverse. Indeed, I've discussed this at a number of seminars. In other words, people pay for their care through a subtraction from the capital value of their house when they die. Local authorities can already do this, of course. By law, they are able to do this. But it's to the, no, they're not used very much, those schemes. They're complicated, they're unpopular, and they tax, as if they're seen to tax the inheritance. And above all, for a local authority, it helps the next incumbent of power in that local authority. That's when the revenue comes in for them. But, I mean, if the state were to have something like the equivalent of a student loans company, which paid out fees to care homes and to local authorities, and, as it were, took the risks that were implied in holding the mortgage asset, and that would be attached to a house during the period that people were being cared for, it seems to me there might be some way of encouraging more, would loosening up, as it were, the capital value of some of that property. So I think there are more things to do in thinking that through. The third point I think that was made was, what are other countries doing? Well, I mean, a lot. There's been a significant amount of pension reform going on in Europe. And I think some of the most interesting examples of that are in Sweden and Germany. And I think the Swedish case is a very interesting one, starting from a very different starting point, where a relatively generous state pension scheme has built in, after a long period of discussion, which we don't have here, between the political parties for about 8 years about how you did this, an agreement reached that you would, as it were, have an automatic process that reduced people's pension eligibility, if you like, in line with changing demography. And that's kind of built into the amount of state pension individuals will get, as well as encouraging people to take out, requiring people, in some sense, to take out funded pension arrangements on top of the basic state pension scheme. And in some ways, a rather similar pattern emerging in Germany. The Italian pension arrangements also reduced the amount of the cost of the scheme, expensive though that is. So it's not. All of these schemes have been incrementally and quite importantly revised downwards. It's not true that electorates can't, as it were, give support, though they may oppose it, as they have in France. France has been somewhat less successful, though still to some degree making changes that are quite important. So pension change to adjust to life expectancy is not impossible, though these schemes are doing so in ways that are from a very different starting point from the British. Immigration, well, clearly there's going to be a lot more movement of individuals around Europe and other places too. And if we could only link some of the issues that I've been talking about today to get a rather more mature debate about immigration, it would be a good thing. I don't think immigration, for the reasons that I outlined at the beginning, are going to, quote, solve the problem for the reasons I described. But it would at least provide a different climate from the rather fevered Daily Mail climate to discuss some of those issues.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I've got two further announcements. The first is that I do not have the date of the following lecture, but the celebrations of our 25th anniversary will continue, and you will all be circulated about that date when we have it. But more immediately, you are all most welcome to join us for a reception over in Stickard. Now, to get there, first of all, it's quite complicated to get there because it's the other side of the LSE, and secondly, at this time of day, you have to get in via a swipe card. So you will have to latch on to a member of the research laboratory or Stickard to get over there. It might be helpful as we break up if people who are members of the research laboratory wave an umbrella above their head and take a gaggle with them. So look out for somebody who's waving their hand above their head and follow them. They may just be hijacking you, but if you're lucky, they'll be taking you over to the research lab. But finally, can I say on behalf of all of us once more, thanks to Howard for a lecture that was a model of clarity, as usual, very thought-provoking and challenging. But perhaps most importantly, a walking demonstration that one of our ways forward involves looking forward to many more productive years of Howard in Stickard. Thank you very much indeed.